This is the BBC.
Hello, this is Podcasting House. If you've never listened before, here's what you need to know. You're about to hear an episode of a new BBC podcast that we think is worth listening to. If you like it, you can go and find it and subscribe for more episodes. And we would probably say find it in BBC Sounds if you're in the UK. I'm Eli, and with me is Rhianne.
Hi, Eli.
And what are we about to listen to, Rhianne?
We are about to listen to episode one of Fatwa. And this is a 10-part series. It tells the story of the life of Muslims and how they have been perceived within British culture, really. And the good thing about it is that it tells the story through using quite a lot of pop culture references, you know, through comedy. So it's a really sort of bouncy look through this, obviously taking it all incredibly seriously, but not sounding like it's taking it all too seriously. Does that make sense?
I imagine
play
it will.
The
I imagine it will. Yeah. Okay, here it is. Episode one of Fatwa.
In 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran issued a death sentence against the British author Salman Rushdie, whose book The Satanic Verses offended Muslims. That's what this series is about.
But that's not all it's about. These protests you're hearing happened not in 1989, but in 2005, when a Danish paper published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. About 200 people were killed. The thing is, it took 6 months before these kinds of demonstrations erupted. That's because they were the result of a small number of hardliners deliberately using the cartoons to provoke a violent reaction. Professor Jutta Clausen wrote a book about it.
A group of imams got together and decided they wanted to protest. So they actually ripped out the page from the newspaper and plastered it up in mosques all over the country. Because if you really want people to be angry, you have to make sure they know what are they angry about, right?
And that wasn't the only time it's happened. Over the last 30 years, something's changed. Offence has been weaponised. Sometimes it feels like everyone's scared of offending Muslims. Filmmakers, publishers, stand-up comedians, even academics. Jutta should know. Her own book about the Danish cartoons was censored by her publishers.
They brought in somebody to explain to me that I myself would be a risk for execution.
But you know, it wasn't always like this. This is the story of the fatwa, the story of how all the anger and the fear started.
I remember Salman saying he thought he'd written a book that might be a bit dangerous.
The continued publication and distribution of the Satanic Verses will represent a time bomb set to explode.
It very quickly became them and us.
Are you with us or against us? That was it.
Satanic Verses as an event fuels a whole Islamist movement.
This is Fatwa with Mubin Azhar and Chloe Hedger-Matteo.
Episode 1. Love thy neighbour.
It's hard to know where this story starts, but it didn't start in 1989 when the fatwa was issued. My family came to Britain from Sialkot in the Punjab in the 60s, and so did a lot of people from Pakistan, India and Bangladesh. Britain got a lot browner in a pretty short space of time, so maybe that's where the story starts.
Pakistanis come to Bradford to do the jobs and live in the houses English people no longer want. Bradford, a city of textile mills, has 12,000 Pakistani immigrants, and nearly all of them work in the mills.
Drinking is prohibited in our religion. But when our people just came in this country, due to the weather of this country, they are not dead drunker, but they drink not too much, just 2-3 bottles in a week or 2-3 pints in a week due to this weather, you see. That's why they are drinking.
I arrived in Bradford about 9
9:30, 10 o'clock at night in the month of November. It was raining, it was dark, it was foggy.
When he was 11 in 1967, Ishtiaq Ahmed's mom put him on a plane and sent him to join his father in Britain. It's pretty hard going.
Extremely hard. And coming to a house, another 11 or 12 working men living in the house. So we had to grow up pretty fast. And I remember everybody in the house congregated in the living room. And the living room at that time was the VIP room for the house owner. He had the privilege of actually having his bed in that room. So the TV was also kept in that room as well. And he would open his room and he would switch the TV on. Everybody would congregate, watching wrestling. Saturday evenings were playing cards. Sunday was about dressing up and going with friends to watch a film. Back to work on Monday.
You have to remember that our parents were born as Indians because the British Empire was still booming. So they obviously saw the white man coming up and down their villages in big cars and, you know, people running behind them, serving them tea and all that stuff.
That's Aki Nawaz. His dad, like Ishtiaq's, got a job in the mills.
Always we had to fight for things or struggle for things. And the school that I went to served one of the largest council estates. So a lot of white people, and they had issues. We had issues.
Britain felt like a pretty racist place back then, not only in school or in the street. In fact, racism was an accepted part of the culture, in politics, in the papers, and on TV.
Caught you red-handed with your black paw in the till, you pilfering packy.
Please, you're making a big mistake.
Yes, that's what they all say. You're making a mistake, my little chocolate drop.
I don't really remember this stuff. I was born in 1979. But my mum and dad definitely do.
I am the new owner.
Oh, no, not another thing.
I think the canned laughter somehow makes it even worse.
Yep, as if everyone's thinking the same thing, like the whole country's in on the joke.
Exactly.
I am no nignak. I am Pakistani. Different colour altogether.
You're all the same to me, Sabu.
One day I can remember some guy had a fight with my brother. And my brother beat him, smashed his face up and things. And, you know, we ran back to the house and suddenly there was a knock on the door and the guy and his dad turned up. And he goes, oh, look what your son's done to my son and all that stuff. And my dad was really kind of upset with my brother. And my dad said, you know, you say sorry to him. So my brother said, oh, I'm really, really sorry. And then the guy goes, I hope you are, you packy bastard. And my dad just stopped and said to my brother, go, do more. And my brother went out and beat the shit out of him in front of his father again. It was almost like you couldn't win. You'd beat the person, but you'd still feel as if you lost because your colour was the ultimate insult, because we still get called packy at the end of it.
So were you on the receiving end of any of this kind of thing?
Well, sure, I've been called a packy, and more recently I've had people jokingly ask me if there's a bomb in my briefcase. But I reckon it was much worse for the first generation. It wasn't just name-calling. My dad was bottled by skinheads in East London. Firebombs were put through people's letterboxes, and there were murders of Pakistani workers. A lot of immigrants felt kind of heartbroken by it all, because they'd admired the British. They thought it was going to be all tea, winter coats and walks in Kew Gardens. Instead, they were getting battered.
They were always disappointed on how England had treated them.
I don't think we knew that much about where the Asians around us were from or what they believed. But then I remember when people like Hanif Qureshi came along and started explaining all this stuff.
I'm dead impressed by all this. You were the one at school, the one they liked.
All the Paggies like me.
I've been through all that.
If you're my age and British Asian, Hanif Qureshi is a pretty big deal. His writing represented British Asians as three-dimensional people, We weren't just props with bud-bud accents anymore. In My Beautiful Laundrette, we are Thatcherite entrepreneurs, we are socialist and capitalist and struggling with love and sex. We are straight and gay too. It might sound obvious now, but at the time, it was revolutionary.
People needed our world explained. You know, what was the new Britain that was emerging out of the colonies? Suddenly we'd been there and now we're here. And what are we doing here? What kind of people are we? And what kind of Britain are we going to be living in the future? You know, all culture, pop, art, everything requires new voices. So I became part of that.
But of course, he wasn't the only part of that.
Salman Rushdie?
Then there was Salman Rushdie and Midnight's Children.
This object here, a tug on my nose, this is human geography. How, sir? Where, sir? What, sir? Zagallo is laughing now. You don't see, he guffaws, in the face of this ugly ape, you don't see the whole map.
Midnight's Children had a huge impact on me. Salman and I became friends. And he was an amazing figure to me because he was older, he was intelligent, he'd written this brilliant book, he was so funny and clever, and suddenly you thought, you know, this new world had opened up for me of somebody who was like me but was older and knew more, like a sort of very, very clever older brother.
Midnight's Children was Salman Rushdie's second novel and his first great success. It's a brilliant book, unless you're Indira Gandhi, who was so outraged by a single sentence, she sued Salman for libel and won. Then there was Shame, Rushdie's next book, which annoyed General Zia of Pakistan so much he banned it. Not that Rushdie was bothered, he once said he thought it was nice when novels were dangerous because art happens at the edge.
First time I came across Salman Rushdie's writing was when I was taking the train down to London.
Bill Buford was an American publisher who revived Granta, a literary magazine.
And I had got a manuscript from the publisher of Midnight's Children. And I was so excited by it as I was on my way down to King's Cross Station that I immediately said, we have to put this in our magazine.
Buford became a champion of what he saw as a new kind of writing.
A kind of writing that seemed to fill a big gap, that seemed to take on things like history and politics and identity. And it was like nothing else.
He really started to get what Rushdie meant to people when he invited him to give a reading in Cambridge.
And I can remember I'd warned him beforehand and said, you know, the book is just out. We've done these things before. It's a kind of a sleepy community. I don't know, you know, sometimes there's only been five people, six people, three people. But there was this whole other audience that he was speaking to, and they all came out. And I remember one woman in a sari stood up afterwards and she's, you know, put her hand over her heart and she said, you know, Mr. Rushdie, I want to thank you. Finally, somebody has written about the India that I know. And it was kind of an epiphany for me.
Rushdie developed a kind of celebrity status, more like a musician than a writer. He was photographed at parties with glamorous women. He was invited to give speeches at anti-racism rallies. But for the Asian community in Britain, it's important to understand this. His status was somewhere even higher. One of ours had made it. Muslim, Hindu, Pakistani, Indian, whatever, we all loved him.
That was going to change.
I remember Salman saying he thought that he had written a book that might be a bit dangerous or that people might not like. But I didn't really know what he meant by that.
Next time on Fatwa.
My house was stoned at night, all the windows were smashed, even threats to my life and to my family.
Episode 2, Revolutions.
I think it's still quite dangerous to put one's head above the parapet.
Fatwa was produced by Chloe Hedger-Matteo and presented by Chloe and me, Mubin Azar. Tom Wright was our researcher. Siobhan O'Connell found the archive, and there's a list of all the archive we've used on the Fatwa pages on the Radio 4 website. The series was mixed by James Beard, our editor is Richard Knight, and finally, thank you to all our contributors. We're really grateful to you for sharing your stories.
Okay, Rhiannon,
I see what you mean. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
You know what I was not expecting, I think, with this is I was expecting a sort of a history of, I don't know, of fatwas or of the Salman Rushdie episode. But it's really a history of racism in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing I like about it is it does that effortless learning thing. So yeah. you're enjoying the tone and the style of the podcast.
Well, it's
you're
conversational.
Picking up stuff all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it feels like you're not working hard, but you're taking loads of stuff in.
That's
so
really
if you
good.
Don't know, if you're not familiar of that race relations story within the UK, it's a really, really good guide.
I mean, I was a bit, but there's the stories that they tell about it. Yeah. Those sorts of specifics, yeah. I mean, I just never thought about it.
And the series just gets better and better and better. And and some of the characters come back and they're woven in and out. Yeah, so it's a really good piece of storytelling.
I'm really, really looking forward to the rest. Yeah, great. Okay, so Fatwa, if you want to hear the future episodes of that, go search for it in BBC Sounds. Fatwa, that's spelled without an H, I think.
That's right, F-A-T-W-A.
All right, and we'll see you next
time. Lovely, lovely imagery as well.
Okay, bye. See you next time. Bye.